Blog Talk Radio.
We have walked into the month of October 2021. It's when black men talk. We know what number episode this is, man. We have done so many, it's hard to keep track. But we're grateful to be able to walk into October 2020. We don't take nothing for granted because a lot of things have been going on, a lot of things have changed. And if you're able to wake up and experience October, the fall, I know up here in the Northeast, the leaves are starting to turn orange, reddish color, it's going to be falling to the ground. Just to be able to experience that and see that itself, to me, is a blessing. I want to thank you for keeping us company. We've been doing this for quite some time, myself, Mark Elliott, Mr. Dean Reese, and Mr. Charles soon to be joining me. And we don't take it lightly that you give us a listen. We're in a couple of different outlets at this point. We're on Spotify, Amazon Podcast, Google Podcast, Facebook, of course, When Black Men Talk. Also, I forget to mention from time to time we're on blogradio.com. And it's interesting. I apologize for those that listen from that source that I don't get a chance to kind of holler out to you because I say to others, but I very seldom I mention that. And when Mr. DeReese pops up, I want to talk to him about it because there's some folks listening from different places that are paying attention, and we want to acknowledge them as well. What is When Black Men Talk? It's a provocative talk that us three will explore the male perspective on life, love, and relationships, an honest self-evaluation, and not shying away from some things that need to be said. And we're always looking to basically give ourselves an honest self-evaluation. Tonight, we're going to spend some time looking at love. I don't think we talked about love in a while. Maybe we haven't, I forgot. No, I don't think we have. And I'm going to put the question out, is love blind? And we know we heard it in songs, might have been in movies, it might even go back to Shakespeare. We're going to take some time out this time, this episode, and kind of look at love. And if love is blind, why is it? And if it is blind, what does it do? How does it basically change our eyesight, in a sense? When I say love is blind, basically, it's one that doesn't see the faults of someone that person may have that they're in love with. And I guess that's kind of where it stems from. But if you look at it, in a sense, I'm wondering if it changes our view as a person when we fall in love with someone and to see that they might be doing some things that we may not be aware of. But when I say love is blind, Mr. DeMaurice, actually, before I do that, I want to go to something I said earlier. I said that folks are listening on Blog Talk, man, and I don't get a chance to really kind of acknowledge them. I haven't acknowledged them like I should. But you and I was talking a little while earlier, and I want to kind of have you mention to me or mention now what you mentioned to me earlier about some of the places that kind of surprised me that folks are listening to us on When Black Men Talk. Welcome in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, of course we have the United States and people listen to us in the United States, but we have Canada, folks that are listening to us in Canada, Australia, Germany, France, Switzerland, the Sudan and Africa. We have folks in Japan that listen to us as well as in Brazil and South America. So we're all over the globe when we talk about Blog Talk Radio and the shows we have, especially When Black Men Talk. And I credit you for putting you on Spotify and Google and all those outlets where people are hitting those outlets also and hitting our station and Blog Talk Radio. So thank you for listening. Please share our shows and keep listening. We have great content coming up.
It's amazing, man, to think that when us three got together, let's say about 4 or 5 years ago, we would have probably never thought that us three would be saying something that people in those countries would want to listen to and hear, man. We just basically come up here yapping and talking and to think that we say things that people that's outside the United States are paying attention to, man. That does my heart good, bro. That's my heart good. As I was going to say before I asked you to speak on that, let's talk about love is blind, in a sense. And when you hear that old saying, how does that rub you?
It means that sometimes we get caught up in the emotion of love so deeply and so hard that we don't see things as they really are sometimes. We tend to kind of overlook things that may not be good or may not be healthy for us at that time. And so that's when I hear the word love is blind, and that's exactly what I think of we can't see things that we really need to see. And that may hurt us in the end once we come out of that emotional state of that love state that we're in.
Interesting, because I'm sure we all experienced this at some point. We had a love, or we thought might was a love. When it ended, we all sit back and go, was that me? How did I do? How did I allow myself? We put those questions to us, like, you know, how did it happen? So I know if I've done it, obviously Mr. DeMaurice might have experienced it. I wonder if Mr. Charles experienced it. So Mr. Charles, we're going to bring you in, sir. First of all, when you're saying that love is blind, how does that make you feel, sir? What's your thoughts?
Well, it just really makes you think that you're all in, basically, or you're even to the point of infatuation, right? When you feel so good about being with this person or whatever the situation may be, that maybe some of their faults you don't recognize or you don't pay attention to. And sometimes you don't even care, because at the moment or moments that the time that you're with that person, things are just great. You're glad to be around them. You probably don't know them yet or whatever. And you just want to continue that harmonious state. And that's why they say love is blind, because you're like, you know what, I'm not going to let anything mess this up. This is a great time, and I just want to bask in it for as long as I can.
I'm going to come back to you with this, Mr. Charles, because you touched on something I was thinking about. Because I think in most relationships, you must learn to turn a blind eye to something, because no relationship is going to be perfect. So I think sometimes we need some blindness when it comes to love, because there's some things that are going to happen that are going to get on your skin, they're going to get on your nerves. So in saying that blindness in a relationship, is it needed or not needed? Back at you, sir.
I don't think blindness is needed, because when you say you blind eye, to me, that's like you just not paying attention to something. And I'm not going to say a blind eye is needed. I'll say this. I think that you have to understand, to me, I always said this before, that you have to accept a person for who they are. You have to accept a person at their worst. And if you can accept them at their worst, then you can tolerate them or you can be with them. And a lot of times we don't find out what their worst is. But if you have a blind eye to it, then you never really understand it for what it is sometimes, I think. So I say no, I don't think that you should do that. You should just know who they are, understand who they are, and just realize, you know, certain times she's going to do certain things that's just going to go, that you're like, oh, man, you know, I really don't like that, but damn it, I love her, and I can tolerate her because that's her at her worst. I can handle it.
I hear you. Myself, personally, I got to be a little blind. Because when things bother me sometimes, I'm one to speak out on it. And if I kind of let the eye go a little blind, I guess that keeps me from not speaking out on it, Mr. DeMaurice. So I'm asking you, sir, do we need a little blindness in relationships?
I wouldn't say no. You can't be blind going into a relationship. I think what you're speaking of is whether or not the behavior or something that they do is a deal breaker or not. So you have to go into it and see it for what it is and go, okay, is this worth losing this person that I really care for, or can I overlook this and still go on? Like if she snores, is that a deal breaker for you? You don't want to go into that blind because you're trying to get some sleep and she's calling the hogs. Can I deal with this for forever? Is this a deal breaker? So, you know, you got to have your eyes wide open, not be blinded to stuff, and deal with it and say, is this a deal breaker for me? Or is this something that, you know, I just can't go forward with? And so, no, I think if things bother you, yeah, you deal with it. If it's something that you can say, you know, it's not a really big deal. But to go in it blindly, nah, it'll get to a point where it irritates you so much you just blow up one day. And the person has no clue what you didn't like. You thought you were cool with it all along, and then all of a sudden, I didn't know you didn't like it. You know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering as we age, because sometimes it can be flip-flop. Sometimes when you're younger, you're willing to put up with more, somewhat of a blind eye, and you kind of overlook some faults. But as you age, does your tolerance tend to shrink when it comes to basically maybe accepting of some things such as snoring and stuff of that nature, Mr. DeMaurice?
Definitely. I've noticed that with myself. That's why I live alone. Because there's some stuff that irked me that it's like, I can't deal with this. And I'd rather be by myself and not dealing with this than to be with somebody just to say I'm with somebody. So definitely as you younger, you don't see it. You're blind to it. It doesn't even come in your radar sometimes because you're so glad to be with somebody that wants to be with you, or, you know, you enjoy that. But as you walk along this journey, you realize that, you know what, this is not something that I want to deal with. I know this is not going to work. I mean, it's very short with me with certain things. And I've realized that. And so I've even told people, you know, this is not something that I really want. So I'm just going to bow out now because if I stay with it longer, it's going to irritate me and, you know, I'm going to leave anyway. So, you know, I might as well just, you know, not deal with this and just be by myself and not kind of just be with somebody with something that's so irritating that I'm trying to look over and, you know, one way or another, it's going to seep in. You know, you're going to be pissed off about something else, and then you're going to, you know, throw that in an argument or a discussion, whatever. So I'm like, you know, as you get older, you get less patience for a lot of nonsense. So definitely.
They just call that getting fixed in your ways, Mr. Charles. I'm wondering as you start to age.
Call it what you want.
Yes, sir. Mr. Charles, you know. I got to admit, my cousin got some tight ways about her, but
get up my lawn!
Yeah, I do. I do. I admit it. I do. I'm bad. I'm really bad. Her feet bigger than mine? Nope. Steel breaker. Can't see the TV.
Oh, man. Mr. Charles, I'm wondering, as you start to age, your tolerance levels tends to shrink or increase? Let's speak for yourself, man. As you start to age, have you noticed your tolerance level expanded or kind of decreased, sir?
It decreased like a month anyway. I'm just saying. No, it didn't have something that shrunk. And that's why D and Maurice and I get along so well.
Yeah.
You have a lot of tolerance for a lot of things. It's like, you know what, that's some bullshit. What the hell was? I agree. You're absolutely right. I won't put up with that either. You're absolutely right. So we're not alone. But I'll just say that I think sometimes, particularly as you mentioned earlier, about being in a relationship, being happy with that person, and sometimes – you know how we are as guys, you know, that may not seem like that for us younger. When you're younger, you're just enamored with you with this beautiful woman. You're glad to be with her. Probably might think she might be, you know, you hit a home run. You might normally, somebody like that may not be interested in me. And you just like all the attributes. And you go, I'll put up with that. But as you get older, you like, and we talked about this before, about that whole courting thing. Anyway, I'm about to get in trouble. But, you know, look, shoot, I bring a lot to the table, too. So, you know, you kind of lucky to be around me because, you know, I'm a catch, too. So not just you, but I'm a prize catch, too. So it's just what it is. So, yeah, I think me as men, we start to look at some men, not all men. Some women I look at it differently. They're like, you know what? Yeah, when we look around and we look at our age range and what's available, I know we're not supposed to compare, but we do. What's available, who our competition may be. Like, girl, you lucky. You better come on and get right. That does happen, ladies. I'm just warning y'all. I'm just telling y'all. Saw it on TV, so it must be right.
Yeah, men too. Men definitely do tend to assess the situation and assess what's going on quietly. We may not speak on it, but we definitely do. But, you know, it's funny because I think over the years, I'm sure my talents in some areas kind of decrease. And I've noticed this for me, And I'm going to come back to you with this question, Mr. Charles, because there's a difference between tolerance and patience. And they may seem like they're close, but there's a separation. And I think in some areas, my tolerance might have decreased. Patience, I think, has increased, which is surprising to me. But I shouldn't be surprised because I really have kind of tried to work on that in a sense. Because I remember before, there was a time when my patience just wasn't bad. I just wasn't like, you know, I didn't have much. And I kind of knew it, and it was something that I felt that I had to kind of work on. So I'm wondering the difference, Mr. Charles, of patience and tolerance. We'll look at your patience first as it decreases along with your intolerance. And if they both have, should we start to basically be a little more tolerant and be a little more patient there?
Wow, that's deep. When you look at that, that's interesting. I like that question. I would say that I know or I believe that my patience has definitely increased because I understand that people, we're all different. And certain things, everybody's not the same, and you have to be more patient with people. But my tolerance, my tolerance has decreased. Just because of the fact that I think some people just do things because they can or it's on purpose. And it's like, okay, you don't need to be doing all that, right? You don't need to be doing all that. It's not that bad. I understand. So my tolerance, and particularly if people keep doing the same thing over and over, and what I mean by that is, let's say you are a person that's a certain way that they are, and they keep doing things over to push your buttons to see how far they can go. And then you go like, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm sorry that offended you. You're like, well, you've done it five times. The hell? You know what I'm saying? Before I was like, okay, well, I'm just glad to be around. And I was like, girl, I told you. Didn't I tell you last month? Being real. Take care. God bless you. So, yes, the patience has increased. Tolerance has decreased.
That's interesting because, I mean, I know when I look at it myself, again, I would think they would kind of both be kind of at the same, but they're not. Mr. DeMaurice, basically, we know where your tolerance is, sir, but over the years, have your patience tend to increase? And, you know, if it hasn't, and maybe same thing with intolerance, should there be something that we look to kind of booster just to be in others' companies?
I think patience has increased because you no longer think as a child. And so you know that certain things take time. Tolerance, no. Tolerance has not increased over the years. I remember there was a 3-year span, man, in my life where my saying was, fuck that, I ain't doing it. It was no tolerance whatsoever. Fuck that, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I'm not going to be involved. It would just come out of my mouth and, like, you know, because you realize that the more you're tolerant, the more you were taken advantage of, or the less you were getting, you just made a fool of it, like, fuck that, I'm not doing that. But patience is, in certain things, you go, okay, this is going to take some time, so I'm gonna you know, be patient with this, or this particular situation, or the job you're doing, any situation that you're in, that you realize that you don't think as a child, and you have to be patient in a number of things in order for things to work, or in order for things to, you know, get to a point where you want them. But yeah, that's a great question because to me it is a difference between tolerance and patience.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, it's interesting talking about love is blind. I think sometimes subconsciously we forget that love basically works on our soul, it works on our spirit, and it works on our mind. And with that being said, I think there's partly reason why some men basically shug and try to avoid love, in a sense. And I'm going to read something that I came across. And it's kind of reported that once you get close with someone, the brain decides the need of access and the character and the personality is reduced. So in other words, you're not paying that much attention to their character and their personality, which might lead to thinking the blurriness of being blind for love. So it kind of starts to blur your vision whether you want to or not, because now you're feeling a certain way for someone, and some things that may have bothered you in the past have been irritant to you in the past. You kind of look at that and go, So I think sometimes, Mr. DeMaurice, I think sometimes subconsciously we know what love can do to us. We know love can basically soften us a little bit, not a little bit, a lot. And it might put us in a reluctant state to move forward to where when that time comes, when your heart says, you know what, you love her, you love her, you love her, you start to pull back a little bit because you're a little afraid that things may start to get just a little blurry for you. Is that possible, sir?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible because I think it goes back to, is this a deal breaker for you? If you know this is what this person does and you know how this person is, can you look over it and does it even bother you? It's like you ever see parents with kids and the kids are just going crazy in the store and the parents not even paying attention to it. And you see it. You see them just going crazy. And you wonder, why don't you say something to them? Why don't you spank them and do something? But they've lived with it. It's almost like it's not even happening. It's like they're just ignoring it. And so I think, you know, when couples get to that point and go, okay, this is the way this person is, instead of kind of harping on it and really kind of paying attention to the behavior, this too shall pass, as grandma used to say. And so it mm-hmm. passes over and you get the person that, you know, you want to be with. You know that they're going to have these spells that, you know, that you're going to have to kind of tune them out. I used to watch my dad do it to my mom. He used to tell me, he was like, you know, sometimes you got to hear and don't hear. Because I asked him, I'm like, how do you put up with such and such? And he said, you got to hear and don't hear sometimes. And I'm like, what the hell do you mean, hear and don't hear? Until I got older and go, oh, okay, I get him now. So, yeah, I think, yes, you know, you're with the person and you go, okay, I know they're going to be this way. So I'm not going to kind of give any energy to when they're this way. And, you know, kind of ignore it, gloss over it, because I know how it'll make me feel and how it'll get me to a point where I'm getting out of, you know, pocket. So let me just, you know, ignore it, you know, let it gloss over. Once they come back, then we can reengage. But I used to see my parents and other people do the same thing. And, you know, I understand it so much more now.
Yeah, I really developed this trait that has served me well over the years. When I first was married years ago, I call it the tune-out factor. And I thought I saw my father doing this. When I realized I developed it, I think I saw my father doing this, but I didn't understand he was doing that. Because my father would be able to, my mother would sometimes, or my father's brothers, my uncles would come by to visit my father. And my father would take the newspaper and hold it. I wouldn't say a word. Like, you reading it? And he was just not there. He, no matter what was going on, he really wasn't there. And I'm looking, you know, as a child, you notice it, you know, I guess it kind of stays in your psyche and you forget about it. So as I aged and when I became married, I developed this tune-out factor where I could be in the room with you and you're talking and I'll hear one word you're saying. And my mind is elsewhere. It's almost like I tuned you out. And I'm sitting there, and the conversation's going on. And I'm like, okay. And at certain points, I would come in, and you would assume I'm paying attention, but I'm not. And
is that
was
is that
something
right?
That, yes, sir. And I found that to be beneficial in a lot of different areas, bro, because it's almost your saving grace, so to speak. And as you say, it keeps you from basically riving or rolling up in certain conversations that there's no need to. It keeps you from basically exploding or kind of following and being involved in sometimes that there's just no there's no need to. So, Mr. Charles, I'll go back to what I just said and the question I gave to Mr. DeMaurice about, in a sense, sometimes I think men are, you know, we're accused of being afraid of commitment and that stuff, but I think underneath that, sometimes when we're kind of hesitant to fall into love, we're thinking subconsciously, how is this going to alter me? How is this going to basically make me feel? Yeah, I may feel this certain way, but am I ready to basically, you know, vulnerability is there, but am I ready to be softened in the case to be with someone?
Wow. Yeah. It goes a long way with that, far as being softened, because even in the Bible, it says about protecting your heart, right? And I think that to be open and vulnerable can be a problem if you do that with everybody that you connect with. So it could be a problem. But, you know, I think that's major. So I think you really have to ask yourself, is this really what you want? You got to ask that question. And I know you mentioned about tuning things out. And I had to learn that the hard way, because I would always let something somebody would say or how they would react, I would let it affect me because of the way that they came across. And I had to learn how to do that. And then once I learned how to do it well, I used to do it in groups. I could be in a group. And I'm like, man, this is not what I signed up for. And I can listen and listen. I'm listening to it, but on the other end, I'm tuning it out. I can do that. I do that at the dentist. Like, go off to another place, man. People are like, you seem so calm. Like, I just blanked out on you. So, yes. No, that's a little different. But just tell them my story.
As you was talking, I thought about this this gentleman I used to work with. He was much older than I was, and he was married much longer than I was. But we're at the same point in our lives of basically deciding whether we're going to remain married or not. So it brought forth conversation through him and I, and he said to me a few things. But then one thing he said to me was that when he was married, he noticed that he would always have a drink in his hand. He said this. He said, Mark, you can come to my house anytime. He said, if I was home, he said, I mean, I've been drinking much. He said, but I had a drink in my hand. And he said, I never understood why. He said, my son asked me one time, Dad, why are you drinking? It's basically, you seem like you're not even taking it out of the glass, but you always have a glass in your hand. He didn't realize, it wasn't until him and his wife went to therapy that was his way of just basically tuning out and coping. If he just put a drink in his hand, of whiskey or whatever, sipped a little from time to time, he didn't follow up, he didn't play into, and he allowed things to kind of happen. And so as him and I discussed more, and I thought this was real interesting, and his wife went to therapy, and he said, you know, after being there a few times, and he said he came to the thought process, okay, I'm at this stage in my life. I'm at an age in my life. I know what's sitting across from me. He said, can I accept that and just deal with that the rest of my life without holding that glass? And he decided that's what he wanted to do. And he said, it may never get better. He said, but I'm just going to just ride that out. And I remember him saying that, him and I both just got quiet. And I was a little surprised to hear it, but I understood him. I understood. And I want to go back to something you said, Mr. Charles, earlier, because what I kind of experienced and what you've learned in life, mainly some things you experienced, other people have experienced, has kind of multiplied. So when you're experiencing, you think it's just you. But when you really kind of open up, you realize, no, it ain't you. You know, what you've kind of experienced, others are going through as well. But it seemed like... seemed like when things are at its best, peaceful, and things are good, that's when the testing and the stuff gets started. For no reason. No reason. It just seemed like if things are too quiet, they're too mellow, and things are rolling good, it seemed like there has to be a test given. I know I experienced it. And then again, maybe I am the only one. But I'm going to put this out to you too, because I'm pretty sure at some point you were thinking the same thing. You might have been in a previous relationship, and it's just things have been going well. And out of nowhere, the curveball comes. You go, where did that come from? Why is it here? And then you realize it's a test. And then you go, why does she keep testing? What's the testing about, Mr. Charles? Have you experienced that? And if you have, what is the testing about?
I have experienced it. I think the testing is about trying to see sometimes how how far they can push you. What kind of person are you as well? And I say that because you are, as much as women may not want to admit it, maybe, I always thought, too, that they don't want a soft man. And I'm not saying you got to be hardcore screaming at them or shaking nobody or nothing like that, but I just think it's about saying certain things should just be stopped or you're not going to put up with certain things. And I see it from that standpoint. But I also know, too, that I've been in positions where somebody has, you said that testing you, and it's to see how far they can go or push you without you, you know, pushing back. But I've also been to a point where I knew that was, that's how it was. And I would always say to them sometimes, would say, look, you just love being miserable, don't you? You know, like, you just love to be miserable. There's something wrong when something is just going too good, you feel like you have to do something. And I'm like, that just made no damn sense to me. I mean, I do get it why people do it, but it didn't make any sense because it's like, I've seen enough bad relationships growing up as a kid and then even as a man watching people just being miserable, not really enjoying being around each other. So if I'm in a position where my relationship is good and I got a good thing going, let's just keep this peace. Let's just not make noise just because you want something different or it's boring to you. So I don't know. Maybe that's why I'm still anyway by myself. All right.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things here at work. I think they definitely want to see how far they can push you. But I think, too, in a strange way, they're always testing how do you feel about them. Because the test comes with not necessarily where you pass or fail. It comes with the way you react is already predetermined how they're going to perceive things. So your reaction sends them a message of either A or B. And what sometimes when that happens is because even when they should be secure in a relationship, they're not. They're just not. For whatever reason, they're not. And they'll tell you, yeah, I am, but they're not. And they're looking, well, you know, and even when it's good, they're looking to find, okay, what could be that potential flaw? So the test involves basically questions that's going on in their mind that they perceive that could be there. And no matter how much you may show it or whatever, they believe it has to always kind of be shown to the way they want it to be shown. So without a doubt, Mr. Reed, I'm sure you've experienced this when things are going well, they're going good. And what happens is us as men, we're fixers in a sense. So we, you know, we basically want to fix something, be done, fix it quick for the most part. Fix it quick, sit back, do something different, relax, chill, enjoy the peace and quiet. I can't say those two words enough. Peace and quiet. It's what we seek. It's what we want, what we desire. It's just what we always want. You can never have enough of that. Peace and quiet. But when it's peaceful, when it's quiet, here comes the testing. Have you experienced it, Mr. DeReese? And if you have, even if you haven't, what's behind it, sir?
Oh, man, I don't know what's behind it, but I used to experience this a lot more when I was married because anytime you get a gift or anytime you get, you know, oh, I'm going to take you out to dinner, you're like, oh, man, something messed up behind this. I know it. It's just too good. It was just too good. So I remember when I was getting ready to go to grad school, I might have told this story before. I was getting ready to go to grad school. I got accepted at the University of Chicago. I was doing really well in my job. And so my wife at the time, she said, oh, I want to take you to dinner and celebrate. And I was really fighting against it. I'm like, no, you don't have to do that. Oh, yeah, I want to celebrate. You know, we need to talk, and you know, about this and all that. And I want to, you know, it's congratulations, all that. We sit that dinner. And I'm just waiting, man. You know what? I ordered everything. I ordered everything I could get. Because I knew this was going to be bad. I knew it, so I might as well get my belly full so I'm too fat to move or too fat to react. So at the end of it, she was like, well, I got some news, too. And I'm like, here it comes. Digging into the dessert. Well, I'm going to quit my job and just take care of the kids and stay at home while you're in school. Now, mind you, working full time, going to school, you know. So I'm you know, doing the things, I'm paying the bills and all this other stuff. But what she announced was going to make it harder for me, and I'm like, bam, there's the hammer. And I just enjoyed my cheesecake sitting there. I'm like, mm-hmm, okay. I didn't react. There's some great cheesecake. It was like I was taking medicine and having cheesecake with it. So I don't know why they do it. I have no idea. But you know the other hammer's coming, so you better be prepared for it. And how you deal with it, you got to be a big man to deal with it in a productive way. Because you know it's coming. It's coming. There's no way to avoid it. It's like a train coming down the track, and you tied to the track. It's coming. So how are you going to spend those last moments before you get ran over by this other thing that they're gonna ram down your throat, whatever? So, if you understand it, you let me know. I'll sit here with my hands under my chin, anxiously awaiting your answer how you figured this out.
I like that analogy. Driving the track. The move. You got nowhere to go.
You can't move. You're stuck. You ain't going nowhere.
Oh, man. I'm going to take a break, gentlemen. We're going to come back after a little short break. But in this break, I'm going to drop a song, man. When I come back, this happened one time on this show. And I've always kind of wanted to know, you have your own thoughts of what it is, what a case may be, what's really behind it. But a while ago, it's been a while, you know, I asked, what is funk? What is P-Funk? What is funk? And Mr. Charles knocked it out of the park. So we're going to do that again, and I'm sure he'll knock it out again. So we're going to drop a little P-Funk before we continue on. We're going to come back and get an edumacation from Mr. Charles on what is really P-Funk when black men talk.
A good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as We Funk, or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the Mothership. Top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me, I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is,
make mine the P-Funk. I want my funk uncut. Yeah, make my funk the P-Funk.
Yes, sir. I want the what? Mr. Charles, here we go, sir. Like I said earlier, man, you took the P-Funk. You ran with it. You explained it to the T. So there's nowhere else to go but to you, boss. What is it? Why does it exist?
My name is Lollipop, a.k.a. the long-haired sucker. So funk music, man, is what makes it different than almost anything else is it's these musicians' ability to take rhythm, right, instrument rhythm, song words, and place it upon yourself, even if you don't understand it, to make you say, I don't understand that, but it generates something inside you that makes you want to tap your feet, move your body, nod your head. And when you hear it again, you go, I don't know if I really understood it, but once you dive into it, it speaks to you. And the fact that instruments are involved and it has its own sense of flavor, and it's the real funk is timeless. It's timeless. And not too many other things are like that. It's timeless. And when you realize what's all been behind it, when it was put together, then you go, damn, that's a masterpiece. Yeah. And you just played a masterpiece.
I did. Let me put my...
never missing a beat. Yeah. Boy, was it neat.
Man, I'm telling you, it's interesting because a lot of people don't, if you, as Mr. Charles stated, you start to kind of feel certain things, but a lot of the songs, a lot of George Clinton songs, man, the music behind it, if you just took away his and talk and the vocals and just listen to the horn, the instrument, and the way it's put together, you say to yourself, damn, it's masterpiece, man. It really is. I think the last time I saw them was a couple of years ago. His name's going to retire. He's still out performing. But the man is 80 now. Think about that. 80 years old out there still bringing the funk. But it was at it was in Columbia, Maryland, at a jazz festival, and they was closing it. And it started raining like a half an hour before they were scheduled to come on. And some people left saying, you know what, I ain't sticking to the rain. I had no umbrella, and I wasn't only waiting, standing there, waiting for them to come out and stood through the rain as they performed, bro. And you know they would, you know what they do when they take the stage. So it was well worth it, well worth it. As we move forward into kind of still in the same mindset that Love Is Blind, I want to ask you, Mr. DeMaurice, you know, relationships basically tend to strive in a couple of areas. Sad to say, either you're winning or you're striving. When I say winning in a sense, sometimes people tend to basically want to win over their partner, not win together. So if you were to take, you know, a random focus meeting of some of your past relationships, will you say the person was more about winning or there's more about striving, or the persons, I should say, collectively, or more about winning or more about striving in the collective relationship?
I think it was more about them winning or them protecting, like a goal line or something like that, so you wouldn't get in. So it is the kind of same thing. It's like a defense. So it was more about them winning and them being on top and them being the person as in the driver's seat, as opposed to, you know, winning together and doing things together and winning and losing together. It wasn't about togetherness. It was about what can I get out of this? How can I get out of this unscathed? How can I be in this relationship and not give too much and still be in this relationship? So it was really kind of a sad testament of, you know, okay. And I remember saying in one relationship that I ended, I'm like, okay, you won. So what's your prize now? And to illustrate the fact that you didn't win anything, you just lost. But you know, you want to be right about this, you want to be right about this. Okay, you won. So what do you get? What do you get as your prize that you walk around with? You know, how are you going to brag about this? And so it was more about winning to them, I think. And that's the sad thing about certain relationships. Once it's over and they think that they're right or they did something that they are proud of at the moment, but the long-lasting effects is that you just lost a person that really cared about you. And I don't think they take that in consideration because maybe in past experiences, but not wanting to take a loss, not wanting to take a loss at all, and holding on to that so much that you do take a loss ultimately because you can't relinquish your anonymity, your independence, and become part of a couple that's going to move forward and win together.
Yeah, I hear you, man. I always find it interesting how we want certain things, but not necessarily through the work that's necessary to have those certain things. Meaning that you may want a strong relationship, but you're not willing to sacrifice, you're not willing to give, be selfless to have that. And, yeah, winning and or striving are on two different sides of the equator, and I don't see where winning should definitely be the choice. But, Mr. Charles, if you kind of took a focused analyzation of what you experienced in the past, were they striving more to win or they basically were just striving?
I'll say striving to win And I think that kind of can go two ways. One way is Miss Dean Reese mentioned, striving for they can be a, can handle the charge of the situation and kind of have it go their way. I can see it that way. But then the other part of it, I can say when they're trying to win, they see you a certain kind of way, and they may even, certain people may be jealous of what you bring to the table, and it's a competition. It's like they feel insecure about themselves, and therefore it's like, well, see what I did now? I'm just like you now. And I would say, why are you doing this to trying to compete? We're not competing. I chose you, or you chose me, and we accepted each other for who we were at that time. It's great for you to increase your achievements and the accolades, but for you to kind of go and try to match me is like, that's not, I mean, what is that? So I'd say that, but I think part of it, too, as we mentioned before, is if you're striving together, that comes with sacrifice, and oftentimes that sacrifice means that people together must let other people go, too. And I'm not saying that you have to cut your mom and them out and everybody like that, too, but they can't be such a strong force in your life if you really want to strive to have a great relationship. And certain people just need to understand they need to take a back seat. And if they can't do that to allow your relationship to go, then you just have to say, well, maybe we need to part ways. But oftentimes that doesn't happen. So that's why I feel that oftentimes that couples break up, because the people that should be striving don't know how to prioritize things in order for their relationship to actually excel.
Yeah, I find it interesting in basically what you said about the competition, because I've experienced that quite a bit. Sometimes it's been quiet, and sometimes it's been very loud. And what I've noticed is they compete with you on the same things that they were attracted to you for. The things that really draw them to you, or them to, you know, they liked about you enough that they wanted to be around you, those are the things they pick up and want to compete with. And you're standing back and you notice it and you're going, what the heck is going on here? And like you said, why is there a competition? And then when there are times when they think they have outdone you, they will literally say to you, hey, I've done this better than you. And you're standing back and going, huh? It's amazing. It's an amazing thing. It just kind of boggles the mind. You wonder yourself, how did we get here? How did this basically start? And no form of fashion, anything that you're doing, I'm trying to do better than you. I mean, my job is to assist and aid and to enhance if I have a job, but not to compete or to outdo you or to excel over you. Is that that mindset? I don't know where I couldn't even start to have that. But yeah, many times when they basically, it's about winning. They take on, they want to win. And as Mr. Reese, they say, sometimes they win and lose the battle of what's really going on, the relationship. And they're not even aware of it. They're not aware. And they feel a sense of accomplishment, Mr. DeMaurice, until they realize it's over. And then when it's over, they come back. They come back and they start to say X, Y, Z. But most of the time, that's too late, bro. It's too late because, you know, and it's not like while they're trying to win, you don't point it out to them and go, you know, this is going on. But they fight not to see. They fight not to hear it. They fight not to understand. So that's why they may come across it later and you have moved on, because when you were trying to basically really handle it, understand it. And again, like I said before, men are fixers for the most part. Men will try to fix for the most part and try to get things kind of corrected. But when a man gives up trying to fix something, when he basically says, yeah, let me rephrase that. When a man stops trying to fix, he's not going to tell you he's stopping. But when his actions shows you he's not fixing it anymore, he doesn't care anymore. That's a part of him that starts not to care, because he realizes that if he fixed this, which he probably can't fix, another job is waiting for him behind it. He's just waiting for him constantly. Or he has his tool belt off, banging and banging and banging. It's like, I'll go back. That piece in that choir, you're always going to be fixing, and you can't get to that piece. That piece in that choir is sitting at the table. You just can't reach that table. Every time you get close to that table, you got to put your belt back on and fix something else. And it's like, you just want to sit at that table. You don't want to be there all day. But at some point, you want to get there. You want to have that peace. You want to have that quiet. Another thing I've noticed, Mr. DeMaurice, is that we are treated sometimes, and maybe we need to be, who knows, but we're treated sometimes as an adversary, more so as a partner, true or false?
Sometimes you feel like you're supposed to, your partners and your partner is fighting against the world. But, I remember it's almost like, and I hate to make this comparison, like sometimes you'll tell a child, you're telling them the right things to do and you're telling them, things to, the void and all that other stuff, and they ain't listening. And then somebody from the out of the blue can say it, and they're listening to it like the gospel, and then they repeat it back to you, and you're like, man, I've been saying that, I've been saying that for a few days now. And, and all of a sudden, Joe Schmo just comes around and mentions it, and this is what the best idea you ever heard. And so it's usually that. It's like they're not, it's not like they're playing on the same team. It's almost like they're playing against you, and they're trying to win something that, to get over on you. And you're like, no, we're on the same team. I'm trying to help you out. But it gets to a point where they can't hear your voice anymore, or they don't want to hear your voice anymore, or they don't find the value of your voice or you being there anymore. And it comes out with they're not listening. They're not listening. And it gets to a point where it's me against him kind of thing. And it's not that at all. You're there trying to help out. As men, we're there to try to fix things, and when we can't no longer fix it, we got to leave it alone because it's going to frustrate you. But that's that's what we're kind of built to be, and I don't think they understand that. And so when when you get to that point where even the person that you're laying next to every night is not listening to you, then what's the point of going on and trying to salvage this if it's not going to work? If they you've exhausted everything you've done and they're working against you, then it's like, okay, then I'm sleeping with the enemy at this particular point.
Yeah, man, that point of confirmation that they seek out from someone else is real, bro. I mean, I've experienced that on a few occasions. And I remember, being married, experienced that quite a bit. And like you said, you would say something, same syllable, same content, same periods, commas, the whole nine yards, and it would not be accepted. No, 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 no. Someone could say it the next day. They'll come back and repeat it back to you verbatim like the first time they heard it. And the staggering part about that, you will say, I said that. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. They will rock. No, you didn't. And you're standing there going like, okay. And here again is one of those situations at the time when it first started happening, I thought, okay, maybe I'm just dealing with this.
Yeah,
so,
you think you're crazy.
Yeah, maybe it's just me.
Did I
say? It's just me. Yeah, man, it's just me. But what really kind of kicked it off was when we were separated, her church was having this couples night. And she invited me to come to her. And at first, I'll go, in a good spirit, I will go. I'll go and sit. So the minister at that time stands up, and his wife is standing right next to him. He says a few things, and he starts to say this. He said, one thing my wife does, there's a few things she does, but there's the one thing she does that always frustrates me to no end. He said, she'll ask me something, we're talking about something or whatever.
Oh.
He said, I'll give her my opinion. He said, I'll give her my opinion. And he said, she'll ignore it and go, no, no, no. And he said, she'll come back the next day or the day later and repeat exactly and then deny the fact that I said it. And, man, I'm sitting there like, I'm glad I came. I'm glad I came. Because it's just not me. It's not me because it's like, That right there, that frustration when it's going on. Woo! And as you said, they don't value it coming from you. It's almost like they don't listen. They don't want to trust you enough that it's coming from you. And as for Eric Hand, if you can't hear it and it loses translation coming from me and it has no value, then what are we doing? What are we really doing? I mean, I don't understand it, but like I said earlier, some of the same things that attracted them to you or they liked about you and decided to spend time with you, to get to be with you, to grow with you, those are the same things they will kind of go up against. Amazing. Adversary, Mr. Charles, or not necessarily, sir?
I'd say definitely adversary. And it's sad because it's usually involving other people. It can be family members, people they work with, connect with, whatever kind of group they're in. And it's just bizarre because I know I would be in a position where this part, so people would have, they would kind of like be the, I don't know, people would come to them for advice, or they would be mentors to other people in their families or whatever. And then they would come and ask questions, what you think about this, and then you mention it. And then when you give them the straight truth, then they go, oh, I can't do that. You just want me to just let them all go. I'm like, no. Sometimes you got to let people grow, though. If you don't, they always will be attached to you and hanging on, like children, as you mentioned before. They'll just hang on, and they'll use you as a crutch. I said, so sometimes you might need to do that. Go, well, everybody can't be like you. I said, I get that. But then the other part, too, comes back to where it would be, as you mentioned, they'd be in a scenario where they have to make this hard decision, and they end up taking the leadership role in a financial decision, and then they come back and would say to me, nobody understands. Nobody understands what I'm going through. Nobody understands this, that, and that. And they asked me what I thought. And I told them, gave them a scenario that just made sense, and they go, nobody else has ever said that. And I was like, well, I guess I'm not always the bad guy, huh? I'm just like, smiling. Damn, for real? Okay, everybody else is feeling frustrated, you're feeling overwhelmed. Nobody else will step up. And I gave you a scenario that everybody can win, and you won't have to carry the burden so much. And she's like, that actually makes sense. I was like, yeah, don't worry about it. Send me a check.
I just don't understand totally how you choose someone to be an adversary with. That one will always kind of avoid me. My logical way of thinking just doesn't make sense. But we experience it over and over and over again. Gentlemen, let's take a little break. When we come back, we'll jump into some questions. You know, we're happy to be moved into the month of October 2021. When you think about everything that's gone on, everything that's taken place, and we could all be doing something totally different, but we're right here doing what we're doing. I appreciate it. I appreciate that these two gentlemen take time out their schedules, their lives, to get together and offer what they offer to the show. And I've always said they're the fabric of what we do here, and I appreciate it. Because without them, I'll be talking for, 90 minutes? That may not be good. But they're here. They show up. They get it done. They open up. And I'm ever so thankful. It's When Black Men Talk. Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott, Mr. D. Maurice. One person's channel that resides in the state of Ohio. That'd be one Mr. Charles. And we come to him first for the question. What you got, sir?
Yeah, before I say the question, I'm going to give you a little tidbit about that funk music. That music, that song Pain by the Ohio Players is kind of orchestrated and put together by a gentleman by the name, the late, great Junie Morrison. Junie Morrison was originally with the Players, left the Players, and joined a group called Parliament Funkadelic, where he became basically the minister of music. And he's been connected with five of the greatest funk songs ever known to man. Pain, Ecstasy by the Ohio Players, and then Knee Deep, Aqua Boogie, and one other selection by Parliament Funkadelic. He was one of the main orchestrators for those five greatest funk songs of all time. There's somebody named Junie Morrison from Dayton, Ohio. Look it up. Google it. Anyway, question is, have you ever dealt with this? It can even go to a point of religious type situations where you see people have an agenda or they have an opinion, and then they grab a verse from the Bible or whatever their book of choice may be, and they choose a certain verse to back up what they're trying to get over. But they fail to realize, if you look at the whole chapter, the way they're using it is not exactly what it was meant to be used for in the whole context. I know that's a lot, but I'm just saying. They picked out what they needed or what to try to prove their point, but they missed the whole entire context of how this verse lies.
Oh, absolutely, bro. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you kind of experienced that. I find interesting is that people think most times when they go to the Bible, it ends the conversation. So they feel like once they bring a Bible part in, it drops the mic. It's like there's no more challenging to it. There's no more of a conversation. And you're right. They pick out something and basically would drop it and think it basically moves the conversation or ends the conversation. And not knowing that all of that doesn't really fits what they're basically trying to say. And sometimes it's done as a form of an impression to try to impress upon you that they're more Bible literate than you, that maybe God favors them more than you. But I don't think they're aware that majority of the time it doesn't work. Maybe in some folks they do. I can't say that because some folks can be impressed upon rather easily. They digest it easily, and they're looking, with the eyes to be glossed and feel like you have a better connection and a better sense of God than they do. So those are ones that are easily to be pulled into that and fall for that. But no, I've seen that many times, and I always go back to something, my mother would say is that you have to know for yourself, realistically. You have to know and be stronger within yourself, because if not, you will fall prey to any time someone else can basically mislead you. And many people, as we know, have been misled by those that can take the Bible and use it in a way to influence, mislead, misdirect, and take greatly advantage of. So, sometimes you need to be aware, astutely aware, when someone's basically using that in a conversation. Your reaction, Mr. DeMarais?
Yeah, I used to run up on this a lot. And then what I would do and what I've done in the past is I've read the whole Bible. And so when they would come up with stuff, and I'm like, well, you're missing a part. And challenge them on, what the real interpretation is as opposed to what they're trying to shape it to be. And that would kind of turn them away from trying to use the Bible as a weapon towards their agenda past, whatever they're trying to get past you. So I would do it all the time, just say, nah, you're taking that out of context. This is what this means. let's get back to the subject at hand here and why you didn't do or this didn't happen. I don't like when people do that because they're really kind of misusing religion and thinking that if I throw religion in here and this person is not as religious as I am, then that can just make me right. Instead of just, you know, dealing with, you know, the situation, you know, right there in front and dealing with it honestly, they want to maneuver and try to, you know, hit you from behind and all the stuff with Bible verses. But it usually stops when you're arguing with a person or you're having a discussion with a person that knows it just as well as you or better than you. So I just don't like when people do that, man. It's really kind of dirty pool. And using religion and it kind of, to me, when they do that, it really sours the person they're trying to give the Bible verses to religion, because it makes them kind of feel like they're less than, just like Mark just said, they're less than you because you know this or you're up on some Bible verses and you're trying to use them for an argument. So I think they don't realize sometimes that sours people into going into the religion or Christianity or whatever religion people are using, whatever verses they're using. That's all I got on that.
Real quick, Mr. Charles, I want to say, I remember years ago I used to go to this one church, and the minister at the time, I've stayed to the congregation numerous times. You know why people from outside won't come in this building? Because you treat them like you're better than them.
Yep.
You think as you come sit here on Sunday, and he would say this, you think as you come sit here on Sunday and you carry that book, you're better than them. And God doesn't see you no better than them. But you treat them that way, you speak to them that way, and they don't feel warm and welcome coming in. And that's amazing, man. That, when you think about that in itself, as you to piggyback on what you said, Mr. Reese, that's part of the reason why a lot of people kind of look at Richard a little bit, kind of, you know, with a, they're wondering, because basically how are you, in a sense, carrying his word, his love, his care, and you can't understand and reach and come out to him and be more compassionate? Something ain't right. Your response to your question, Mr. Charles.
Yeah, it's really sad because you mentioned about the church. I know I've been to a church, and just because some people didn't recognize you or they've never seen you before, maybe you're visiting for the first time. And then I guess I had heathen written on my forehead. they were grilling me like I didn't know the Lord. And I'm like, did you take time to ask me a question or ask me about let's go through a conversation? And I was like, wow. So that just kind of turned me off. But I think, too, that when people use the verses and out of the Bible out of context, you're right, it does affect people that are maybe brand new, and it turns them off because they're at a certain place when they first come in. And you have to, I believe, meet people where they live first before you can help them dive in and change the life of what you're used to. The other part of it, too, that I find quite bizarre and is interesting at the same time is when you think about it, a lot of these so-called cults have used the Bible verses to, you know, may orchestrate what they want to get across to people. And they've been wrong as hell, but people dive in, and even some, I would just say this, depends on what you believe in, some modern-day cults do the same thing. And you come to find out, like, what the heck? Open your eyes and find out for yourself what's really going on before you dive into it. And I've seen that. And then people swear, well, such said this. They come to find out that person was wrong, and they still have a problem walking away when it's been proven wrong because they're so enamored with the individual and not what they're really supposed to be there for in the verses.
You know, a lot of people like the show, bro. It's the show that's more attractive in some time than what's being said, what's being spoken. They like the show. And a lot of times they go for the show. They go for the show. And a lot of those same people that go for the show will come home and look for the show on television. They're attracted to the performance. They're not attracted to what's being said, what's being given out, what's being done. They're not. They're attracted to the show. And that's what a lot of it comes down to, the show. They want to be entertained big time. And if you're charismatic and you can provide some entertainment, bro, you haven't fallen. The doors can't keep them in. It is what it is. They're attracted to the entertainment, and they lose sight of what they should be paying attention to. Your question, Ms. DeMaris.
Yeah, I want to keep on this theme of the funk. Who introduced you to the funk? Do you remember who introduced you to the funk?
Ooh, man. I don't think there was anybody per se that introduced me to it. I think I stumbled upon it when I was younger. But I remember there's these cats, they're my age, and maybe a little older. And we used to have dancers at this school in next town over. Back then, this was called Michael J. Welling. I don't know if you remember that school, but it was a junior high school. And these guys would throw dances there, not every Friday, but from time to time. And what they would do, they would have a DJ. And the DJ basically would play music, you know, for the first hour or two of the dance, and people would dance. And then they would go, like, up on the stage. And they were musicians, these young cats, and they would play Parliament Funkadelic Cuts from. And these cats were good. They were good. So they were that good to where a few years later, a place in New Haven that still exists, that big, well-known acts has come through of all different type of music genre, have come through and performed. Toads plays. Toads would have them come down from time to time, man, and that's all they would play with Parliament Funkadelic. And, you know, we grew up at a time when basically Parliament, their audience was, for the most part, let's say were black. But over the years, and some people I talk to that don't look like me, they say it was listening to Parliament way back then. I don't know if I should question it or not, but when you go to their shows, they're up in there and they know the lyrics front and back, man. So they've been learning somehow, listening to it somewhere. But I think it was basically I kind of probably stumbled upon it like anything else. You come across something so unique and so strong, you start to pay attention, you research it, you want to hear more of it, you want to hear more, you go back. And just understanding where he came from, man. Because some of his early stuff he did years before he grew into that sound, I couldn't listen to. I wouldn't be able to listen to it. I went back and I tried, and I was like, mm-mm. But when he changed the sound, bro, when George Clinton first came out, because if I remember correctly, he was a barber. And,
yeah, he was doing doo-wop.
I couldn't get with that. But when he changed the sound and moved it around, bro, it was like, and think about music back then too. Everybody had their own particular sound, so it wasn't okay if George Clinton was doing this. It wasn't 20 other people trying to sound like George. Everybody was doing their own thing. Now, if you sound a certain way, everybody's trying to emulate you. They're trying to come behind you. They're doing that. But back then, you was able to have your own creativity. So when his stuff hit, it was nothing else like. It was just bang. But that's it for me. Your reaction, Mr. Jones?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I know my cousin introduced me to the Isley Brothers. I had no idea. I was about 12, and I was like, what the hell is this? And I'm sorry it took me that long to catch them, but I understand them. But I think the funk probably for me was the radio and skating, man. Because we used to go roller skating, and I was like a kid, like, 10, 19 years old, 11, or even older. But when we skated at home, there was no kids session, right? So it wasn't like the kids skate on Saturday. We went Friday night with the adults, and we were skating with them. So we're listening to their music. And with that being said, you're listening to that funk. And then I think, too, the reason why I say the radio as well is because – you're growing up in Dayton, Ohio, and all those bands and the groups, how they play, man. So we heard Ohio players like all the time slave, you know, later Lakeside, things like that. But we heard the players when they came out with new stuff, we were like the you know, the testing ground. And our radio station at the time was it was on fire. And that's what they played. They played funk. So yeah, definitely the radio and like I said, skating.
Isley Brothers, man, it's one song. Let me say this real quick before I come back to Ms. DeMaurice. Imagine someone bites you over, and, you know, you're coming over, and they open the door, and they walk away. But they walk away. What's playing real loud is In Between the Sheets.
Yeah, right now.
When that first came out, woo-hoo-hoo. Your response, DeMaurice.
Man, when I thought about this, man, because me and Mr. Charles, we do a show called The One, and we've been talking about doing the show on YouTube. And I was thinking about this, is that, man, my whole life has been a soundtrack because you had cousins and uncles from both sides of the family, family parties where you're playing James Brown and being around Uncle Kurt. He's playing the Ohio Players and all these different influences and being around my cousins in North Carolina, and my cousin Bill, who's playing different funk from, you know, that area. And you know, just both families that I belong to were all on the same page with music. And that's all you heard. You were surrounded by music. You were surrounded by the funk. You were introduced by older cousins. You sat up in Saturday mornings and watched Soul Train. It's like you were immersed in it. And it's like you don't know. I can't tell you the first song that I heard, but it's like you were born with it, and it never leaves you. It's that constant music that never leaves you, and I don't care what they come up with now, you always go back to it. And so I have to thank both sides of my family. You know, cousins, uncles, aunts, everybody who just kept the music going. And they didn't have to tell you it was good music. You felt it. You felt it, and you were good with it. You were good with it. It wasn't like, oh, you need to like this. No, they put it on, and you go, whoa. Like a familiar friend. Hey, how you doing? Hey, you know, and you're dancing, you're moving. You're seeing everybody else moving. Your friends are all into it. And it's like... it's like a safety blanket or something like that. It's always there, man. Thank God for it.
Yeah. Can I throw one thing in there real quick?
Oh, please take your time, Ross.
Yeah, one thing he mentioned. I remember my first 45 I bought, and it was the Big Payback by James Brown. Man. We had a stereo. I wore that thing out. The Big Payback by James Brown. And it's music like that that you just kind of, as you mentioned. And I also remember Dancing Machine by the Jackson 5, man. You know, how many of us try to do that damn robot, bro?
I thought the other day I was trying to do it.
Yes, sir.
How many of us boom, boom, boom. I mean, bro, come on. Come on, bro.
Yeah, Jackson 5 was no joke, man. We kind of forget them from time to time as we age. You know, we kind of forget they were part of our youth. But the Jackson 5 was like, ooh, that some of the songs they came out with. I mean, and back then, songs were only like 2 or 3 minutes long. They weren't that long. They was real short.
Uh-uh.
But they were short. Like you, Mr. Charles, one of the songs that I remember playing on 45 that we had, because you had back then, your record player was your TV, your record player, and your radio all in one. The record player was on top, the TV was on top. You only could play one at a time. You could do both. But this is a group to me that never got the attention, and they probably had one hit, Archie Bell and the Drell. You want to tighten up?
Mm-hmm.
That song right there was my jam, boy. Oh, the tighten up. Oh, did they were like break down like one instrument player at a time? Oh, yeah. Mr. Charles, your next question, sir.
Yeah. My next question is, as you get older, do you find yourself with more friends and more friends, less acquaintances, or more acquaintances and less friends?
I'm gonna tell you, man. I've noticed that I've gotten older, I don't have patience or a lot of tolerance for a lot of friends. I just don't. If I see you, we chit-chat, we good. But I don't know if there's – I don't have the time sometimes to just be like and be that. And there's a couple of buddies of mine, man, that I'll be honest, I got to be in the mood to talk to them. I got to be in the mood. It's just sometimes you're just not up for the conversation. And I think for me, I've always been one of a loner but not alone. So if I'm not talking or whatever the case may be doing, I'm good. You know, I'm good alone. I have no problem being alone. I think I told you a few years ago, Mr. Reese, I used to date myself, bro. There's period of times I would go things on my own. So with that being said, company conversation is cool, but there's time when it's not necessarily wanted, and I'm great. I'm great. So answer to the question, I think my friends have definitely shrunk down. Acquaintances probably are more because you run into them or things that happen from time to time. But far as friends, yeah, it's way down, bro, way down. Because to me, a friend for me is we don't have to always talk after D, but when we do, we let it go. We talk, we get into it. But no matter how much time has elapsed from the last time we may have talked or seen each other, it feels like it was just yesterday. So the number has definitely shrunk over the years. Your response, D. Maurice?
I think I have more associates now than friends because, you know, in life circumstances and things happen, you tend to realize who your friends really are. And I don't live in the same city as my family lives in, but I've grown, even with cousins and uncles and relatives, I've grown closer to them where they are friends to me. And we're family members, but we're friends. And with some of my relatives that had turned out to be, you know, friends, because, you know, sometimes family kind of, you know, they'll do you in. And so you have to really kind of distinguish yourself who's friend and who's foe. And I will say I have sometimes I have counted some friends as family members. So they transcend just being friends. They're family to me. So that's a real and I'm family to them. So so that's kind of like a higher honor that I feel for those friends who have graduated to the point where, you know, I talk to them more than I talk to my own family. But yeah, I tend to have more associates now than I've ever before because they might have been on that road to friendship or we might have called each other friends, but you kind of see how they're living and how they're doing and you don't really agree. And then you kind of slowly back away and go, okay, let me stop contacting this person to see if they will contact me or see how I'm doing. And once you see that they're not doing that, you realize where you are in that relationship.
Good point. Good stuff. Your answer, Mr. Charles?
Yeah, probably more acquaintances or more associates. And my circle's never really been large anywhere when it came to friends. I think because I had to spend so much time by myself that in order to get in the inner circle, you had to. Yeah. I didn't need a bunch of friends because I didn't need a lot of questions and also didn't need a lot of, I guess, you know, people trying to share their opinions with you. I'm like, I don't need all that. So only a few folks. So I would still say definitely it's gotten smaller too because I think seasons change and people change. So how you connected with somebody before may be a lot different today. So I definitely say I have more acquaintances or more associates than I do friends right now.
Yeah, Demarius, we'll wind it down. We'll come to you for the last question of this show, sir.
I want to kind of relate it to sports, man. What the hell's happening?
What the hell?
What the hell is happening, man? I don't understand this, bro. I really don't understand what's going on. The teams, you got no business winning the game. And all of a sudden, they popping up and they want to play now. It's just kind of strange to me, man. I'll leave it there, man. I don't know what the hell is happening.
I'm going to say this, man, and I look at some teams that I don't know if the hunger is there for a lot of these players like it used to be. And I look at – I'll shoot the Tennessee Titans. I'm watching them play. I just don't see any passion. I don't see the passion. I don't see the hunger. I don't see the fight. And I think week in and week out, I think some of these players, for whatever reason, are having a hard time mustering it up and having that ready to go, that competition. And it's unprofessional to an extent because a professional – your level should always be consistent. It should always be there. But I think the current day player, for whatever reason, I don't think they're taking it serious much anymore. And we assume that, you know, when it comes to football, a lot of these cats want to win Super Bowls. No. A lot of these cats just want a good payday. And I can't be mad at them. You just can't be mad. But I think once they get a good payday, the complacency tends to start. And they may act like that's what they want, but they're not dying or destined to win a Super Bowl. They're not dying or destined to be in the Hall of Fame. There's only a small amount of players that are basically riding that boat. And I think that's what you see from time to time. I think that's what you come across where they don't take the field and they have that impact. Your response, Mr. Charles?
Yeah, I think it's I think the league has a lot more parity in it, and I think that we've become accustomed to the way that we saw certain teams play or certain franchises play, we're accustomed to them winning certain games. And I just think it's totally different now where anybody's available to win and you can't take it for granted. I'm not sure how many more dominant teams we have anymore just by what we see on the field currently. And until they prove me wrong, I'm going to kind of follow that.
I'll give you a minute, Mr. DeMarie.
I'm still perplexed, bro. I'm still perplexed. It makes you think things are shady because you know that these teams are not really as talented as you know, they are. They are who they are. And then you see that, you know, teams maybe taking them lightly. Oh, this is an easy schedule. Maybe they went out the night before. I don't know. But it's sure screwing up my picks. I'm glad Jason Fields won today. I'm glad he had a good game compared to last week. Detroit is they're exactly who we thought they were. I would say that. But some of these, like the Jets, it's just perplexing, man. I'm sitting here with a big old headache, bro, just trying to scratch my head, trying to figure this out. And it's like, it's a mystery. The NFL is still a mystery. It's still a mystery. That's my thoughts.
Say this real quick. You know, Urban Meyer was caught at a strip club over the weekend, young gentlemen. What's this world coming to when a head coach that loses three games can't get goes to a strip club on the weekend? What's going on with this?
No.
We get together soon. Y'all stay black.